landing, she paused. Father must have been in a rush that morning. He had left his bedroom door open. Karen hovered in the doorway. She couldn't remember the last time she'd seen inside. In the days after Mother had died, when no one was really watching her, perhaps, but certainly not since. The brightly covered cushions were gone from the armchair. The bed was made with precision corners. The hairbrush on the dressing table was rulered into place. There wasn't a speck of dust or any sign of a personality. The room could have jumped from a recruiting poster. Its military sparseness filled Karen with gloom. She was about to turn away when a memory grabbed at her. Mother's jewelry box. It used to sit on the dressing table over by the window. When Karen was little, her mother would let her sort through its trays and emerald-lined drawers. She remembered holding earrings up to her face, twisting her head so the coloured chips glittered back from the mirror, wrapping herself in the necklaces and bracelets and holding up her arms as if she was dancing, loving all the pretty pieces that her mother never wore. The heat was dredging up strange thoughts. She couldn't have remembered that right. Forgetting about her portfolio, Karen crossed to the dressing table and ran her fingers over the red-tinted wood. Every Christmas and birthday, without fail, Father had bought Mother something new, and she wore whatever it was for a day, and then away it went, into the box. Karen sat down on the padded seat, images whirling faster than she could corral them. Father was always so eager when Mother unwrapped the ribbon-tied packages. What was it he had said? "Did I get it right this time? Does it make you happy?" Karen couldn't remember what her mother had answered and why no one had ever mentioned it when the pieces went unworn, or asked why she had packed them all away and ignored them, even though she must have known it would hurt him. More unanswerable questions. Where was the box now? Karen stared at the stripped-out room as rage roared through her. What had he done with it? Had he cleared it away like everything else? Anger was far easier to embrace than confusion, far easier to act on. She wrenched the top drawer open. There was nothing in it but tidily rolled socks. Without a care for the mess, she tore through the dresser, tipping out its contents. The drawers tumbled onto the floor, revealing nothing but him. Fueled by a fury she refused to push down, Karen moved onto the wardrobe. Jackets and suits formed up in rows as neat as a regiment. She shoved them aside, dug into the corners. Even if the box was gone, surely there would be one thing he had overlooked. One tiny memento. Still, nothing. Karen stepped back, rumpled and sweating. There was only one place left. The long shelf above the wardrobe's hanging rail. She grabbed the stool from the dressing table and clambered up, sending hats and scarves spinning. Stretch and stretch, and there it was. The jewelry box, buried at the back, almost out of reach. Karen hooked it out and jumped down. Throwing herself onto the floor, she opened the inlaid lid. The treasures she remembered were all safely there. Karen forced herself to slow her breathing and steady her hands, frightened she might break something. She lifted the earring tray out first and ran her fingers over the chains and pendants curled in their compartments below it. Then, as carefully as if she was handling blown eggshells at Easter, Karen lifted the jewelry out, piece by piece. She took her time, holding each one up to the light and pressing the metal to her skin. Convinced, a shiver of perfume still whispered through them. When she had cradled each one, she lay it on the carpet with its companions, so they formed a circle round her, arranging them by colour until there was only one piece left. A heavy oval locket with an E, for her mother's name, Elizabeth, engraved on its lid. Karen picked it up, but the clasp was caught on the felt lining. As she tugged, a piece of the thin material pulled away at the corner. There was something underneath which looked like the edge of a piece of paper. Expecting a receipt or a list of the box's contents, knowing how Father liked order, Karen teased it out. It was tightly folded, slightly yellowing, and so thin the center tore slightly when she smoothed it out. Heiratsurkunde was typed in black script across the top. Karen had no idea what it or any of the faded words underneath meant. She held the flimsy sheet up to the light. There was a signature at the bottom and a date, 18th of April, 1947, together with a stamp containing what looked like a bear, and the inscription, Die Stadt Berlin. She could also make out what seemed to be addresses. One had vanished down to Rathaus, but the other was clearer. Lindenkirche, Homburger Straße, and there in the middle, printed in a darker ink hand that had weathered the years, were two names. Andrew Cartwright, Corporal, British Royal Military Police, Lisa Elfman, Schneiderin, Haus Herber. Karen read them again, but the names didn't change. Had her father been married before he married her mother? And to a German girl? It wasn't impossible that he had been in Germany. His regiment still had troops there, as far as she knew, and, although it was never discussed, Karen knew he had fought in the war. It wasn't hard to picture him stationed in Berlin, or involved in the fighting there. But married to someone else? That was far more of a challenge. Karen put the paper carefully down and returned to the box. One tug, and the rest of the lining gave way. This time, the document was thicker and blue, and she knew exactly what it was. A British passport, dated 1947, the same as the yellowing paper. It was made out in a neatly printed hand to a Mrs. Lisa Cartwright. When Karen fumbled it open, her mother stared back. "Who is she?" Karen snapped on the hall light as the front door opened. Her father jumped. "Why are you still up? It's gone 11 o'clock. She didn't move from the bottom stair where she had been sitting for what felt like hours. She wasn't certain she could. "Who is she? I mean, I've seen the picture, so I know she's my mother, but the rest? The name on the passport and this thing? Makes no sense." She dangled the onion skin thin certificate and the passport with the tips of her fingers, keeping them just out of his reach. "What the hell?" He stepped forward. "Give them to me." The hand he stretched out towards the documents was shaking. He's afraid. He's acting like he's in charge, but he's afraid. The knowledge gave her courage, kept her voice steadier than she had thought she would manage. "Who was she? My mother, I mean. What was her name? It can't be the two here. Lisa Elfman makes no sense, and neither does Lisa Cartwright. My mother's name was Elizabeth." And there he was, back again, chest all puffed up as if he was on parade, addressing her as if she was one of his rawest cadets. "Karen, I don't know what nonsense you are imagining, but this is neither the time nor the place. Those things do not concern you. You had no right to take them, and I won't tolerate such behaviour in my house." It might have worked if he hadn't been so obviously sweating, if she hadn't heard that pompous tone so often that she was numb to it. "What are you going to do? Put me on a charge?" She stood up so that they were more equally balanced and thrust the flimsy paper towards him, although she still kept it just out of reach. "This thing is German, isn't it? I'm guessing it's a marriage certificate? I've been puzzling over it for hours, wondering if you might have been married before. That seemed the most logical explanation, but how to explain the passport with mother's picture and this new name on it? Can you help me with that? Is that certificate actually yours and my mother's? Can you explain how that can possibly make sense?" She stopped, gave him a moment to answer, and then whipped it away when he stared blankly back. "Or, you know what? Don't bother. I'll take it to the library and find a dictionary, or, better still, I'll take it to the head of languages at school and get her to translate it." That snapped him back. "Why do you always go for the most extreme option? Why must you turn everything into a fight?" He was blustering, turning red. Karen could have picked his next words for him.
You're hysterical. I won't discuss anything when you're like this.
That old favourite. What a surprise. But I'm not, though, am I? I'm perfectly calm, and I'm not letting this go. I know you prefer to hide behind silence, but this time, that's not happening. She didn't expect him to rise to the challenge. She thought he'd stay tight-lipped and send her to bed, buy himself some time to find a plausible explanation that he would lay out in precisely clipped tones in the morning. His tumbling words dropped her back down onto the stairs.
All right. Yes. It's a wedding certificate, and yes, it is mine and your mother's. And the reason you don't recognize the name is because your mother wasn't English. She was German. She came from Berlin.
All the fight Karen had been so carefully nurturing drained away.
That can't be true. That's ridiculous.
She waited. So did he. Now she was the one blustering.
And even if by some madness that's right, why didn't I know before? It never seemed important to tell you.
She stared at the passport photograph while her father stood perfectly still.
It never seemed important. Really? Are you serious?
Not a flicker. His shutters had come down.
This name, then, that's on here, Lisa. Was that hers?
Originally, yes.
But why did she change it?
His hands were behind his back. His voice had dropped to a monotone.
When she first came to England, that seemed the best thing to do. Elizabeth was a simpler name to use after the war, a more obviously English one. A German name wouldn't have been a kindness.
Karen stared at the documents she was still clutching, trying to understand how his words could be at once both completely logical and completely unbelievable.
I don't understand. How could she be German? She never sounded German.
And then a memory popped up and took on a new meaning. She had a lilt in her voice sometimes. I always thought it was so pretty.
Are you saying that was an accent? And there were times when she used to stumble on a word. I remember that too. Or she would go round in circles until I found her the one she was looking for. I thought it was because she was tired.
Sometimes it was. Your mother had lost most of her accent by the time you were born. She had learned English as a child, and later, she worked hard at smoothing out her voice.
Karen leaned into the banister as the world began spinning. Why did I never question any of that? When she looked up, she could see his face had softened. For a moment, she thought he might move towards her, that he might reach for her hand. She thought she might let him hold it, if he did. But he stayed where he was.
You wouldn't have. Not then. You were a child. She was your mother. How she sounded to you was, well, how she was.
How can he be so removed? Why can't he see what this is doing to me?
Her anger began rising again. Karen let it come.
What about in 1947 when the passport is dated? She must have sounded more German then.
This time, her father shifted slightly, although his voice held.
It was more noticeable, yes, and people weren't always kind. That was why she worked so hard on her voice and didn't really mix much. I'm not sure what else I can tell you.
He's trying to close me down. He's trying to wriggle away like he always does.
Karen straightened herself. She folded the papers up and wiped her hands on her jeans.
She didn't really mix much. Well, that's true. She didn't have any friends, did she? Why was that? Was it because she was ashamed of where she came from? I've wondered about this before, not that I've ever bothered to ask you. Well, maybe now you can help me. Maybe you can explain why my mother, who was beautiful and gentle and should have been popular, was always alone. Do you fancy giving that a go?
His hands rammed into his pockets. Karen's stomach muscles clenched so tight, her voice turned into a growl.
She came to school with me every day, but she never mixed with the other mothers. When her customers brought their patterns and their alterations, she barely asked them in. She always hurried them away. She said she could tell someone's size by looking, but that wasn't the point, was it? Was she afraid of what people would say? Of how they would treat her, even after so many years? Was being German still a sin so long after the war? Her father stepped away, his feet shuffling as if one more question would push him back through the door. No, that's not it. Not exactly. She was shy and she didn't like army life, that's all. She wasn't comfortable around soldiers. He blushed as Karen gaped. Something she had never seen him do before. I'm sorry. I know that sounds strange. His voice was shaking. He had his hands out now as if he finally intended to hold her. Karen pressed herself against the wall and away. She didn't like army life or soldiers. Am I being thick here, or isn't that quite a big thing? When you've married one, I mean, and you live next to a base? If she felt like that, why did she marry you? And if you knew that the life she would have to live here would make her unhappy, why did you bring her? She left him a pause to reply, but he simply stared at her. She charged on. Was it because you made her? Is that why she never talked about her family? Why there's no photos? Because you dragged her here, away from them. I bet they didn't approve. I bet that was it. You were a British soldier bringing her to a country where she couldn't be a German and to an army town when she hated the army. They couldn't have wanted that. So was it some weird control thing? I've heard about that, about men who do that. Didn't she love you enough? Did you need her to be on her own? Isolated in a strange country, so she'd stay with you. Is that why she ended up killing herself? She stopped, panting for breath, her throat raw. The tear-filled, help me, she wanted him to hear, impossible to voice, the pain she was in too all-consuming to move past. Her father was staring at her, not moving, his mouth open and useless. There was such shock on his face and such sorrow. Karen thought for a moment he might have glimpsed below her anger and seen her need. And then he roared, and she knew he hadn't seen her at all.
Be quiet! Who do you think you are questioning me like this? What do you think you know about life? All these theories, they're nonsense. They're utterly ridiculous. You're meddling in matters that are nothing to do with you, and I won't have it. What your mother was, what our marriage was, is none of your business. This rudeness stops right now, young lady, right now.
Karen wanted a father. She'd got a parade sergeant. She doubled over, winded, a hand pressed to her mouth to hold back the nausea.
Oh, God, Karen, I didn't mean to sound so harsh.
He realized he'd gone too far. On some level, Karen knew that. It didn't matter. He wasn't quick enough to repair the fault. Before he could get any more words out, she ripped the gulf threatening between them wide open.
It was your fault. She killed herself because of you as much as me, more, from the sounds of it. I hate you. I'll never stop hating you. I wish you had died instead of her.
She threw herself up the stairs and into her bedroom, gave way to sobs that racked through the house. If she had paused for a second, if she had turned round, she would have seen her father crying as heartbrokenly as her. But she didn't spare him a glance. Chapter 5. Lisa. Berlin, July to November, 1938. Why was she torturing herself like this? What was the point? It was July. The summer season was in full swing. In any other year, the book would be bursting with fittings. This year, page after page, had stayed blank. The few orders recorded there, sitting as awkward as ink blots. Lisa flicked through them, as she had done last night and the night before. A day dress for Frau Posen,
an evening gown for Frau Kuhlmeier. Three more entries that were equally reticent. No jackets trimmed to match the dresses, no coordinating hats and gloves, no beaded capes or chiffon wraps in a week's worth of colours. A handful of orders, all specifying plain cuts and pared-back trimmings. House Elfman's clientele was not simply shrinking. It was afraid to show off any traces of wealth. She closed the book and switched off the lamp. The accounts were waiting, but she couldn't bear to look at them. 2 years ago, even with the loss of the Hertie account, no one at House Elfman had worried about the salon's financial security. Money was there to be spent. There was always plenty more to replace it. Now, those days felt like a lifetime ago. The banks had withdrawn credit in April. Their last backer had swiftly offered his regrets. Lisa had slashed the wages bill to the bone, but the red numbers kept rising. All the hours she had spent in this office crowded round her, listening to Paul daydreaming collections, watching Otto pore over the budgets that brought her father's fantasies to life. The salon's rhythms had once seemed as unshakable as the seasons they followed. "I don't want to direct the salon. I want to be its chief designer." Was it only 2 years since she had said that? Now here she was, trying to hold the whole house together in hands, far too young for the task, spread thinner than tracing paper, and knowing barely half what she needed. She wasn't balancing the weight alone, not entirely. There was a handful of seamstresses still working, women who had never worked anywhere else and were stamped through with loyalty to the salon as deeply as she was, who, like Lisa, had never imagined their future to lie anywhere else. And there was still Otto. He did his best to keep the wheels turning, but, with Adifer tightening its grip on the industry, he spent more days on trains, crisscrossing the country grubbing for suppliers than he did in the salon. As for Paul, Lisa rubbed eyes that ached more than an 18-year-old's should. He hadn't replaced her, although he had threatened to. She hadn't reacted when he dealt with her insubordination in his office by ignoring her. She was too used to that treatment for it to matter. When he finally asked her why she was still coming in every day, even though she wasn't wanted, she had told him the truth. "I love the business as much as you. It's my family. It's what you brought me up to believe was important. If you won't walk away from it, neither will I." He hadn't questioned her commitment again after that, but nowadays he came to the salon in a rush and tore through his visits. His behaviour was erratic. One day he would be close-mouthed and secretive, squirreling away money in padded brown envelopes when he thought she wasn't looking. The next, he would be loud and demanding. He was never listening. He was always too busy to consider what now, or to review empty ledgers. He was maddening and exhausting and no help to anyone. "I'm best used as an ambassador. You and Otto can manage the shop." He threw the line out like a compliment or a carefully considered decision, refusing to admit he was as frightened of the future as her. Refusing to face it. Lisa knew all too well that if Paul stood still for a moment, the way the days forced her to, the silence would stick to him. The salon was running down, wearing out piece by piece like a tired old watch. There was no more hushed chatter in the public rooms, no more shushed babble backstage. The workrooms were frozen. There were no hissing irons, no clattering scissors, no pulleys creaking muslin-shrouded dresses like clouds across the roof. The curtains in the dressing rooms bloomed dust in their pleats. The gilt mirrors in the showroom sprouted tarnished patches like age spots. Memories were all that made up the salon now, as easily pulled out as pins. The canopied front door opened so little, its hinges had stiffened. Their last customers sat at home and summoned, turning Lisa into a peddler, hawking her patterns and her ribbons through back doors and garden gates. "I'm not selling." Paul's repeated refusal continued to ring through the hallways. Not that anyone heard. Not that there was anything left to sell beyond a building and a tattered idea. For all Paul's bravado, and whether he chose to believe it or not, the party had still ground the Elfman business to dust.
So they can remove us. So they can lift us out of our lives.
Michael had been proven right, and these days was involved with the resistance deeper than ever. Gone with his comrades, far more than around, even though Lisa needed him, if only to share her fears. She didn't bother him with that anymore. The demands of the struggle, always won over the whims of fashion. And how could she blame him for making that choice? Lisa lived in the same battered reality as Michael. She woke up most days wondering how dresses could possibly matter. But I have to keep it all going because what else can I do? She couldn't imagine what a life without the salon meant. As her father's heir, she had expected to live outside the narrow roles that most women of her social position inhabited. She had certainly never yearned after the purely domestic kind of life that the Nazis proclaimed kept women happy. A home, a husband, children, nothing more. And now, even if she had wanted that, the men she had once mixed with had either disappeared or, with her heritage, wouldn't look twice at her. There is nothing left but the salon, so the salon must keep going. She told herself that every day to get herself out of bed, to paper over the truth that the salon no longer mattered, that the world she once inhabited had splintered, that every circle her life had overlapped was slipping away. Clientele, workforce, the fashion community, whose origins she had never spared a thought for before the party changed the rules of ownership and belonging. As Otto had predicted, Hertie's renaming had only been the start. Business after business had been wrenched out of Jewish hands or been defamed and ruined. New plaques swarmed across stores and salons. Old owners disappeared as legacies that should have endured down the years were plucked away or left to wither. Faces familiar since childhood had vanished overnight, taking their skills to London or to America or to anywhere religion wasn't the first question asked.
We could follow. With our reputation, we wouldn't be starting from scratch. Look how well others have done.
Otto had kept pushing. Lisa had kept hoping that Paul would listen, although she no longer bothered adding her voice to the argument. Instead, as fashion house after fashion house closed and reopened, all shiny and German, and still no one came for House Elfman, Paul took it as proof that the salon was invincible.
Down they all go and look at us standing.
Some days, Lisa wondered if he was going mad. The clock on the desk struck 10. She should go home. She was so tired, more tired than she had ever been through the sleepless nights a show demanded. Sitting now, alone in the dark, Lisa could have cried for those days and their nail-biting bustle. They were gone. Autumn-winter 1937 had been the salon's last showcase, although no one knew it until the day itself dawned. The fear, the excitement, the rituals, the weeks and weeks of work, all that ran on the same. But this time, invitations went unanswered and no one requested tickets. Not even Agnes Gerlach. Helena Stahl, who was still battling to do her job in the publicity department, didn't tell anyone that, as she didn't tell anyone that she had been forced to pay the invisible on-the-day journalists to attend. She had said nothing until the moment of opening clicked by, and the door stayed firmly shut.
I thought it would be all right. This is House Elfman. Nobody ignores us.
A reasonable assumption, if it hadn't been for the party memos suggesting people should. The showroom stayed empty. The dresses, expecting their debut, sat unhatched and unwanted in their muslin cocoons. Paul shouted. Otto wrote letters. Neither was heard As Berlin's mood stiffened, the Elfman clients, who could choose where they shopped, went to rub shoulders with Nazi wives at Ramatsky and at Maggie Ruf, Frau Goebbels' new favourite designer. The clients who couldn't go anywhere else stretched their dresses across the seasons or ordered travelling costumes, plain and practical garments, one-off purchases. As for the department stores, the German ones had followed Herr Bruckner's lead and abandoned Haus Elfman. The international ones were nervous of Hitler's posturing and couldn't be relied on to come. "You're the last fly in the web. They'll swallow you up too, you wait." Helena's parting shot, delivered when Paul blamed her, nastily, for the show's fiasco. It had wormed under Lisa's skin and led to dreams she woke from, heart racing, legs kicking, giant spiders in pursuit. The quarter hour chimed. She stretched her stiff neck. She should go home. Except the emptiness there would be worse than here. Her parents rushed round their nights as much as their days, flitting through the receptions they could still wrangle invitations to. Margarita dressed in Paul's designs, as if anyone still cared. There was no one waiting for her, no one to share and soften the day. Lisa stopped that thought as it started to spiral. If she began to feel sorry for herself, she would never leave the chair. If she imagined the next day unfolding exactly like this one, she wouldn't have the strength to step into it. Not home then, but perhaps the workroom. The seamstresses were struggling with the dress Paul had demanded for Margarita's upcoming birthday dinner. Its design involved flounced cape sleeves with chiffon cascades which needed delicate work and lengths of material their plundered stores could barely stretch to. Solving the most efficient way to create those would take the concentrated work needed to wear her out and buy a few dreamless hours on the sofa. Lisa rubbed her fingers supple again and was about to get up when the door opened. She shaded her eyes, expecting a light to snap on. Someone entered, but the room stayed dark. The footsteps weren't Paul's fast click or Otto's shuffle. They were soft, deliberate. Lisa pulled up her feet as a figure headed towards the desk. Drawers slid open, papers rustled. A hand pushed back an unruly flop of hair. She switched on the lamp. "What are you doing?" Michael stared at her like a rabbit a step away from a fox and jumped, dropping one of the envelopes Lisa knew was stuffed full with notes. Envelopes she had so far resisted, despite their temptation.
"Are you stealing? Surely not. You can't need money so badly you'd do that. If something's wrong and you're desperate, why wouldn't you just ask?"
Then he turned more fully towards the light, and the money and what Michael was or wasn't doing no longer mattered. His face was striped with blood, his left eye swollen and bruised. He didn't seem to hear her gasp. He didn't waste time on an apology.
"I didn't know if you'd listen, and I'm not taking it for me. It's for the resistance. This money will pay for leaflets and the campaign we need to encourage recruits."
His defense gathered speed, bristling him with energy, pushing him onto his toes.
"We need to get the word to more people that we're here, that we're fighting back. We need to get the workers out of the factories and marching."
Lisa was barely listening. She couldn't take her eyes off the damage to his face. She moved round the desk and reached for his purpling cheek.
"What on earth happened to you?"
He brushed her frightened hand away.
"It's nothing. We ran into a patrol. There was a fight. We got away. If we'd had more men, they wouldn't have chased us in the first place, which is why we need to pull in more members. It's time to mobilize, Lisa. We just need one big push to make people understand what Hitler is doing, how he's feeding his war machine while working men go hungry, how Austria is the start, not the end of his plan, how we have to take action and stop him."
He had snapped to attention like a soldier, his one good eye burning bright as a beacon. The sight of his cuts and bruises throbbed through her. Lisa knew Hitler's annexation of Austria the previous March and the harsh measures taken there against the communists and the Jews had lit a flame under Michael. She was hardly surprised that his behaviour,
that his belief that an uprising was possible had crystallized. She sympathized. How could she not? But that didn't mean she had to like the danger his actions exposed him to.
Forget about all that. Have you seen the state you're in? Won't you let me call a doctor?
He shook his head. I'm fine. He grabbed the envelope back from the desktop where it had fallen.
I need to get this where it's needed.
He was wild-eyed, barely looking at her. Lisa's stomach flipped as she realized the lengths he was prepared to go to.
You're going to get yourself killed.
Michael grabbed a second envelope and slammed the drawer shut. The casual way he ignored her fear and helped himself, without any thought for who might take the blame from his stealing, suddenly made her see red.
Didn't you think someone would notice the money's gone? Weren't you worried who might have been blamed? I don't get it, Michael. Some seamstress who's barely clinging on as it is could have lost her job. How does that fit with your love of the worker principles?
Why didn't you trust me enough to ask for my help? Why won't you let me help now? Was what she wanted to say. But her pride wouldn't let her. Michael stuffed the money in his jacket.
Don't be so melodramatic. There's plenty left.
Too much for anyone to notice what I've taken. And your father can spare it. The struggle needs it far more than he does. That he was right didn't help. Lisa was suddenly so weary of it all, so sick of the stupidity. Paul hiding money while he pretended his business and his country was healthy. Michael believing a handful of men and some poorly printed leaflets could slow down a Führer who had rolled over Austria without a hand raised in protest. Her, 18, and thinking she could stop a crumbling fashion house from collapsing, or that it mattered any more if it did.
I don't want to do this. I'm done.
The realization caught her by the throat. She didn't believe in the business, not with the passion she once had, not with a passion like his.
How could she? Take it.
The speed with which his mouth dropped open would have once made her laugh.
What am I doing? Why am I trying to pretend that dresses are still important? It's a fashion salon. That's not the same as a family, no matter how much I try to kid myself it is. It's going to fall sooner or later, so take it. Fund your campaign and your recruiting. I hope it works. I really do. And I hope you won't get shot.
She stared at the cuts marking his face and shivered at the prospect of worse.
Have you thought about that, Michael? About getting wounded or killed and what that would do to Otto? Or about how crushed he'd be if he could see you standing here, clutching your spoils like a common thief, rather than doing the honest thing and asking? When the salon crashes, you'll be all he has. Doesn't that matter to you at all?
His hands twitched. His face flushed. If he had said, yes, of course it does, she would have emptied the drawers and given him everything.
No, I can't let it. The cause is what matters. Beating the Nazis is what matters. Family is nothing next to that. And if I can see that, even though I know how much my father cares about me, surely, with the parents you've been saddled with, you can see it too.
He held out his hand. Lisa stared at him, reeling from his words, wondering if he was asking for more money.
Come with me.
What?
Come with me, Lisa. You're right. None of this matters. We could use your brains and your courage. I've seen you battling to hold this place together. Think what you could achieve if you put that energy to better use.
I can't.
It was an automatic response.
But she could.
Her parents lived in a fantasy world. That didn't mean she had to stay in there with them, feeding their delusions out of a worn-out sense of duty. She could leave with Michael right now. Find a life with more meaning. His hand was still out. She stepped towards it.
What would I do if I came?
So much. We need people with an eye for detail,
who can think ahead and plan. You would be...
His excitement was cut short by the front door slamming.
Who's there? Why can I hear raised voices?
Otto barreled into the office, dropping his bag as he came.
Don't tell me you two are still finding reasons to squabble. What is it this time?
Lisa jumped back from Michael's outstretched hand, scrabbling for an answer before Michael could mention the money or announce she was planning to leave the salon and join the resistance.
It's nothing. Michael was lecturing. I didn't want to know. The usual stuff.
Otto wasn't listening. He was staring at his son.
What happened? Who did this to you? Have you been fighting?
Of course I've been fighting. What else am I meant to do?
Michael was still looking at Lisa.
Are you coming?
She wanted to say yes. She really did. But then she looked at Otto, saw how aged and brittle his face seemed when he looked at his son. Her shoulders slumped.
I can't.
Michael's curse made Otto wince. Lisa tried to grab his arm as he stormed past.
You don't understand. They need me. I can't pretend I don't know that. I can't let them down.
He shook her off and ran for the door, kicking it shut behind him with a crash that rattled the walls. Otto was left clutching at air.
What did he mean? Where were you going?
Nowhere. It doesn't matter.
Otto dropped into a chair. He looked old and broken, and far too vulnerable to be left. Lisa picked up Paul's brandy and poured him a large measure.
You're exhausted. Sit quietly. Never mind Michael for now. Where were you? You've been gone for ages, and it's clearly done you no good. I thought this was meant to be a quick trip, Hamburg and back. But you've been gone nearly 2 weeks.
Otto drained his glass and held it out for a refill.
There was nothing to be had in Hamburg, so I went to Munich and Stuttgart and half a dozen towns in between. All of it hopeless. Everywhere is controlled as tightly as Berlin. Every factory and supplier is plastered with Adifa stickers and has a blacklist of Jewish businesses as broad as my arm. I couldn't secure thread or buttons, never mind fabric. We'll have to cast the net wider, maybe to Poland. That might keep us afloat until the French buyer comes.
The French buyer? André Bardou,
firmly holding on to his position as Paris's trendsetter. Paul believed Bardou was still loyal and swore he would come in November with his checkbook open. Once, Lisa would have been breathless at the merest hint of his arrival, poring over every detail of their brief, flirtatious meetings. Now, she doubted Otto believed in this lifeline any more than she did.
You'll kill yourself, and to no purpose. Even if André is still allowed to use us, we don't have the bodies or the funds to complete a collection. If he comes at all, he can take the unsold stock from last year. Or not. Other than him, we've virtually nothing. 5 dresses ordered at most. The fabric we have left can do for them.
The question, what next, hung there unanswerable.
Let me see.
Exhaustion made Lisa clumsy. As she reached for the order book, she dislodged a handful of rice marks, which had fallen out of the snatched envelopes.
Has he been stealing from the salon? Tell me the truth.
His voice sounded so hopeless. Lisa bent to scoop up the notes rather than face him.
No, of course not. I gave him some money. I thought he might find a better use for it than me wasting it on stock.
Otto sighed.
I know you're covering for him. He's been taking money from me for months. For this fight he's pledged his life to, I presume. I pretend not to notice. If I tackle him, he'll leave, and then what chance do I have to protect him?
His voice broke on a sob.
He's going to end up dead. He's a Jew and a communist, and not quiet about either. What does he think is going to happen to him? We haven't seen anything here yet compared to what's coming. The party still has its gloves on. That won't last. Not now they've had a free run in Austria. Attacks, expulsions, mass arrests, and none of it challenged. They're not taking Jewish businesses there. They're taking Jews.
He was crying freely now, without noticing the tears.
Why wouldn't your father listen to me? Why wouldn't he leave? I should have gone. I should have taken Michael away when he threw in his lot with the KPD. But how could I abandon your father? The pair of them have torn me in two.
His face had caved into shadows and bone. Lisa clutched his hand, but there was nothing she could say to soothe him.
Michael is going to get killed. If I don't do something, if I don't get him out, my boy won't last the year.
How many lies did Paul think André could stomach? Lisa twisted her napkin under the table as her father batted the Frenchman's questions away.
Have times been tough since the Führer moved against Austria? For some, perhaps, but not House Elfman. You've heard rumors that say otherwise, our competitors trying to discredit us. You know how this industry works. The last show, such a triumph, such a shame that you missed it.
On and on he went, piling up his tall tales until Lisa was convinced she would suffocate. Otto had stopped trying to intervene. André had grown steadily quieter. Paul gave no sign that he'd noticed either. He'd been deftly not noticing a thing since they'd stepped out of the November chill and into the warmth of the Hotel Adlon. Lisa, however, was raw with discomfort. All the years her family had patronized the hotel, all the money they'd spent, and yet tonight they were invisible, shuttled into a corner until André came down to the lobby and rescued them. Lisa had blushed when she saw his frown. Paul had greeted him with overdone delight and swept ahead of André into the restaurant as if he was still king of it. He had behaved in his usual exuberant fashion, dispensing waves and blowing kisses and moving too quickly to see how they were taken. The maitre d', who had run the restaurant since Lisa had needed a high chair, waved them to a table tucked into the shadows. Paul thanked him effusively for respecting their privacy. He laughed away the long wait between courses and pronounced the empty bread basket a good thing for his waistline. Lisa couldn't tell whether his performance was brave or deluded. From his increasingly fixed smile, neither, it seemed, could André.
Perhaps we should order coffee, balance out the wine?
Otto motioned to another waiter too busy to notice.
Let me arrange it. They seem rather stretched.
André rose with a bow for Margarita and a smile for Lisa that shivered with promises. He was so ridiculously handsome, with his dark blonde hair and eyes the blue-green of sea glass, and still as enamored with her as she was with him, or so his whispered asides suggested. Lisa watched him walk away, his stride unhurried, his smile for the waiter generous, and momentarily forgot the embarrassments that had come before. Then Paul opened his mouth and reminded her,
I told you it would work. A good dinner, a cozy chat. We'll have an order out of him before the brandy arrives.
This is madness, you do know that. Paul put down the fork, heaped with the chocolate cake he was trying to tempt Margarita into eating.
Excuse me?
Once the icy stare would have stopped her, but Lisa was long past being the good little girl trying to please her father. That had ended 2 years ago in his office.
Were you listening to yourself? House Elfman is untroubled. The last show was a hit. What show?
André's not the fool you're treating him as,
He must know we've not had a collection out in a year, that we're barely able to trade any more.
She expected fury or at least indignation. Instead, Paul's lower lip disappeared like a child caught out in a fib.
Lisa pushed her dessert plate away, her stomach churning. When would her father start living in the same world as the one she was forced to navigate? How did you even persuade him to come to Berlin? What lies did you tell him?
Paul poured another glass of wine before Otto could move the bottle. His face was as red as the lobster he'd guzzled.
Don't get high-handed with me, miss. The salon's still mine. You've not pushed me out yet. And there was no persuading, because there was no need.
We exchanged some letters.
He mentioned the illness that kept him out of Germany last winter and the worries over Austria that kept him away in the spring.
He assumed he'd missed our shows.
I don't know what news they get in France about the way things are being done here, so I didn't correct him. No persuasion and no lies. I didn't need them. Unlike you, Monsieur Badou still respects who I am.
He not only looked like a child, he sounded like one. Margarita slammed down her glass and glared at her daughter.
Apologize to your father, young lady. I warned him a little responsibility would go to your head, and now here's the proof.
A little responsibility. Lisa ignored her. Her father's smile was so smug and self-satisfied. It was hard not to slap him.
What did you think would happen when André came? Even if, by some miracle, he doesn't recognize that the dresses we have left are a year or more out of date, he'll see that the salon's deserted. He'll speak to his other clients. You do know he's going to find out the state we're in.
Paul swatted her away as easily as he'd dismissed André.
But he won't. Didn't you hear me lay the groundwork? If anyone says anything negative, we'll call it the jealousy I've already mentioned. As for the salon, we can tell him it's being redone and bring the dresses here. You can retrim them and your mother can model them. He'll place an order, and then, when I get word to the party about the valuable international business we're still doing, they'll beg us to begin showing our collections again. I've thought of it all. I didn't even need Otto.
He bowed to the table and sat back, as if he was expecting applause. Otto stayed focused on his wine glass. Margarita broke into coos at Paul's cleverness. Lisa couldn't think of a single reply. She didn't know whether to be grateful her father had finally, if uselessly, acknowledged the business was in serious trouble, or scream at his unshakable bravado.
I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad tidings, but I think something's wrong.
André's return was such a welcome distraction. It was a moment before Lisa registered his words or his frown.
Forgive me being away from you all so long. Herr Lindgren was insistent about explaining the changes at Wertheim, and I couldn't dissuade him. While we were talking, the waiter brought him a message. There's trouble spreading round the city. A riot, from the sound of it. Although, that is surely unthinkable. Except the other tables appear to be getting the same news.
Otto scrambled to his feet, his first thought clearly the same as Lisa's. Not unthinkable. Michael, and the protest he'd been promising since the summer. Lisa craned round, expecting to see the restaurant emptying, its well-fed diners running in fear of baton-wielding communists. No one had moved. The waiters still circled. People were laughing. She thought she heard a toast celebrating a lively and long-needed night.
It can't be that serious. No one looks concerned.
Then why is Vogel running over as if he's got wheels strapped under him?
The maitre d' was at the table before Lisa could find Otto an answer.
Monsieur Badou, forgive me, but your guests need to leave.
Why?
Lisa jumped in before André could speak. Vogel didn't look at her.
There is a disturbance.
Then surely we're safer staying here. No one else is moving, so I assume that's what you're encouraging the other diners to do.
This time, Vogel looked straight
at Lisa. He didn't offer a smile or a more smoothing tone. Echoes of Hertie's prickled her spine.
That isn't possible, not in your case. I've asked for your car to be brought round to the garage and would suggest you make your way there at once. Monsieur Bardou, as our guest, this difficulty doesn't involve you. You are welcome to stay here or retire to the lounge where coffee is waiting.
Vogel bowed and was gone before anyone could work out a response. André stared from one to the other.
I don't understand. Why would he treat you so rudely?
Because we're Jewish.
Lisa shrugged as André's eyebrows shot up at the bluntness of her answer. She ignored Margarita's horrified gasp. There was a strange relief in saying the words, and nothing to lose by continuing. Whatever is going on outside, Herr Vogel is clearly more concerned about the danger to the hotel from us being here than the risks for us if we leave.
Welcome to the New Germany, where the party hates Jews, which means anyone who wants to stay in with the party must also hate Jews.
She smiled at him as if they were still flirting. Didn't you guess we weren't the Adlons' favourite guests? The table is barely in the restaurant. If you hadn't made the reservation, I doubt they would have seated us at all.
André flushed. Well, yes, of course I noticed the change. I've eaten here with your father and Otto countless times. I could hardly miss it. And there's been some disquieting things reported in Paris about the tightening attitudes here.
He turned to Paul.
But you've been talking all night as if everything was normal. As if all the takeovers and the missing faces I've asked about were of no concern. I knew your family is Jewish. I said I was worried. You told me quite clearly that the new rules didn't matter, because House Elfman was different, too important to interfere with.
Lisa burst out laughing and couldn't answer when he asked her why. Vogel looked over. He gesticulated at the door.
I'll fetch the coats. Inviting trouble by sitting here won't help.
Otto rose heavily from the table. Paul followed him, his arm round a white-faced and indignant Margarita.
Let me at least come with you to the garage. Make sure you get safely away.
Lisa realized André was still beside her, his hand outstretched to help her up. She let him guide her through the restaurant, grateful for a shield against stares that felt icy.
None of it was true, then? What your father said?
No. Lisa tumbled over a potted account of the business's fortunes as they made their way down a staircase that was far dingier than the lobby's gilded sweep.
You've been managing the whole thing by yourself? You've always been smart. But you've changed since I last saw you. You've grown much more confident. It suits you.
She glanced up at him, that smile that crinkled his eyes. It melted her every time. The stairwell was so narrow, it was hardly surprising to find him pressed close as they navigated its turns. Despite her brave words, she was shaken by Vogel's complete disinterest in their safety. It was a comfort to find André's hand on her shoulder, his arm round her waist, and when he stopped, when he tilted her chin and kissed her. She thought she knew his kisses by now, but this one was different. The ones before were butterfly whispers that had made her feel giddy. This one encircled her, reached down inside her, demanded another she was more than happy to sink into. His hands were urgent, the wall against her back cold as ice. She could have let the Adlon slide away completely. But then Paul's pleading voice crawled up the stairs and shattered the spell.
He won't drive us. It's quite ridiculous.
When they reached the basement, both her parents were bristling.
I keep trying to explain that I can't.
Stefan, their chauffeur, was tight-faced and struggling to stay patient.
The streets are covered in broken glass. The tires would be shredded in minutes. It's not an excuse. I've been out there.
It's frightening. So what André heard in the restaurant was right. It is a riot. André's hand whispered round Lisa's back, his fingers falling tight as thistle down against her bare skin. She forced herself to concentrate as the driver answered her.
No, I don't think you'd call it that.
Stefan hesitated.
A riot suggests something unplanned and chaotic. Whatever this is, it's very well organized. Word has it there's shops smashed and looted all over the city. But it's the brown shirts and the youth brigades causing the damage, not undisciplined mobs.
Do the attacks seem random or specific?
The cavernous garage almost swallowed Otto's voice. Stefan's face fell.
I can't be certain. I only saw a handful of streets. But if what I heard is true, they are very specific. It's only Jewish businesses that have been targeted. Apparently there's stars and vicious slogans painted everywhere, some of them on windows that haven't been broken yet, as if the paint is a sign of which ones to attack. And there are synagogues on fire all across the city. The one I passed had firemen beside it. But they were hosing the other buildings down, not bothering the one that was burning.
Margarita began to shake. Lisa instinctively stretched out a calming hand, but Paul was already there. Stefan continued, quickening his telling as though he wanted it over with.
It's not just the SA thugs out there on their own. The security police are on the streets too. There's rumours of mass arrests, of Jewish houses smashed into and the owners snatched. So, you see, I can't take you home. Even if we could find a way round the broken glass, I don't think you'd be safe there.
We can't stay here.
Paul's voice was even thinner than Otto's. He was right, the garage was freezing and too open to the street to feel safe. André whispered to Stefan, who reluctantly led him outside. When the two men returned, André was trembling.
He's right. The streets are dangerous. You can't risk it, and there's no point appealing to the hotel again. I have a suite. There is space for all of you in it. If we use the back stairs, no one will bother us.
André rallied. Lisa could almost see the mental shake he gave himself.
This must be a misunderstanding. Yes, there is trouble, but I can't believe it's as targeted as you think. Things looking brighter in the morning is a cliché for a reason.
No one had the energy to argue. They trooped after him, grateful to have been spared a treacherous journey home. When they reached André's rooms, Lisa went straight to the window. It was late, long past midnight, but the sky held the orange tinge of a sunset, and its blackness had an uneven texture, like dye, that had spilled onto bunched fabric and gathered in patches. She pushed open the pane and tasted smoke in the air, wood-filled and musty. A sudden vision caught at her of Michael up to his neck in the fighting, and she shivered.
Close it. Come away.
André had produced glasses and whiskey. Lisa held the drink but couldn't swallow it. The oily liquid smelled like the sky. André smiled round the room as if he was hosting a cocktail party.
Well, at least you're all safe now and can get a good night's sleep. There's nothing to be done till tomorrow. There's a radio in the corner. Why don't I find some music? It might help us all relax.
No one spoke as André fiddled with the dial, flipping backwards and forwards between stations offering the same bland diet of folk songs or military marches. No one complained when he gave up. The room split itself into camps. Paul and Margarita, having already claimed the main bedroom for the night, curled onto the largest sofa and began whispering to each other. Stefan, clearly awkward at sharing such an intimate space with his employers, found a chair in one of the shadowy corners. Otto prowled the room, fussing at the window, sitting down and getting up again until Lisa began to feel dizzy.
Come over here.
André was sitting in an overstuffed armchair he was pretending was big enough for two. Lisa hesitated, glancing first at her parents. They were far too wrapped up in each other to notice anything she might be doing. André patted the seat again. She slid in beside him. He smelled of
spices and lime. She let him slip his arm round her, let him nuzzle his lips against her hair.
Tell me about Paris, André.
He moved her closer into his side, until the length of their legs was touching. She smiled and threaded her fingers through his.
Please, it would be a distraction. Tell me about the music and the nightclubs and what the women wear.
André was such a skilled storyteller, Lisa completely lost track of time and place. He had her sipping martinis under dimmed chandeliers, dancing in rooms thick with perfume and red velvet, running barefoot down the Champs-Élysées hand in hand. When she heard raised voices, she presumed it must be a Parisian gendarme.
Tell me you didn't. Tell me this is some kind of a joke.
Otto was on his feet, looming over Paul, who was slumped on the sofa with his head in his hands.
What's going on?
Otto answered Lisa's confused question, but didn't turn away from Paul.
I was trying to explain to your father what tonight actually means. That it's an ending. That we have to stop stalling and get out of Berlin. And he agreed.
Lisa jumped up, startling André out of the dreamy state he had lulled them both into.
But that's a good thing, isn't it? So why are you cross?
Tell her, Paul.
Her father's voice was so small, Lisa had to cross the room to hear him.
We don't have passports. Not ones we can use. When we were meant to surrender them last month and get the new ones stamped with a J, I didn't do it.
Why not?
Paul shrank further into himself. Lisa could feel her heart hammering.
Father, I don't understand. The Nazis were very clear it had to be done. I saw the order. It was on your desk. You must have known.
Paul continued to stare at his hands.
I did, but I thought I could find a way round it. I didn't see why we should be labelled. And then, yesterday, another letter came. If I don't turn them in, I'll be arrested. If I'd been at home when this started.
Paul broke off as Margarita cried out.
Even if I could find a sponsor somewhere in America or Europe to vouch for us. I don't think they'll let me leave the country now. Or at least, not with the money we'd need.
He tailed off, turned to comfort Margarita.
His arrogance will ruin us.
What's wrong, Lisa? What has Paul done or not done? What is this problem with the passports?
Lisa didn't know where to begin to explain the humiliations that were becoming a part of their everyday life, that were so alien to the elegant world André inhabited. She was grateful that Otto answered him before she could try.
We need to leave Germany and start the business again, somewhere safer, and for that we need paperwork, which Paul now doesn't have.
He turned his attention back to Paul.
Listen to me. This has made our situation harder, but not impossible. Not if we're clever enough. Tomorrow, when things have calmed down, you will go and surrender the passports. You'll tell them it was all a mistake and that you're sorry. That will buy us some time to make plans, to decide where to go. Not America, that's too complicated. Somewhere closer. I just need to think.
Well, if you want somewhere close, that's easily done.
André was on his feet, pushing his way into the conversation.
Paris? You must go to Paris. Isn't that obvious? I've just been telling Lisa how wonderful it is. And if you think it's time to go, what better place to restart the salon than Paris?
Otto finally gave André his full attention.
And you'd help with that.
André beamed at Otto and bowed to Lisa.
Of course, I would be charmed to show Lisa my city. I would have asked her to visit. Whether you needed to leave Berlin or not.
He caught up Lisa's hand and kissed it.
But you knew that anyway.
She didn't.